I just hope that the people of Iran, of Venezuela, of Cuba, of Russia and China continue to hold the line, because people in the West of consciousness and conscience are depending on them to free us all.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me on this debate. Author and political commentator Jonathan Fryer out of London and out in Edinburgh. John White, author and commentator. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش ثم استوى على العرش الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly. And He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Shipping company says an explosion has struck an oil tanker that was discharging at Saudi Arabia's Jeddah port. U.S. President Donald Trump says he's worried that his country will have an illegitimate president as the Electoral College is set to convene to seal Joe Biden's victory. Also ahead, the UK and the European Union agree to continue their talks to secure a post-Brexit trade deal without offering a new deadline for an agreement. Top story: an oil tanker has been hit by an explosion near the Saudi port city of Jeddah. Shipping company Hafnia, that owns the vessel, said BW Rhine was struck by an unidentified external source. The blast caused fire and oil spill for a brief time. New crew injury or no crew injury, that is, was reported. The vessel, which was carrying over 600,000 liters of gasoline, that should be, I'm guessing, was operating within the main tanker anchorage at the Saudi Aramco Jeddah port. The incident comes as Yemen's Ansarullah forces have stepped up their retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia. Last month, Ansarullah targeted a Saudi oil distribution plant operated by Saudi Aramco with two missiles. U.S. President Donald Trump says he is worried that his country will have an illegitimate president.
No, I worry about the country having an illegitimate president. That's what I worry about. A president that lost, and lost badly. This wasn't like a close election. You look at Georgia. We won Georgia big. We won Pennsylvania big. We won Wisconsin big. By the Democrats, and actually,
Trump made a comment in an interview with Fox News. He said the November 3rd presidential election was rigged by the Democrats at local and state levels. Trump stressed that he is willing to move forward with lawsuits challenging the election results. That is while a series of his election fraud claims and his request for overturning the results have been rejected in different states, including Wisconsin and Texas. Trump has so far refused to concede defeat to his Democratic rival Joe Biden. The U.S. Electoral College is expected to certify Biden's victory on Monday as it convenes to cast vote for the country's president and vice president. Correspondent Ronnie Carvalho says on legal terms, there is no way U.S. President Trump can change the results of the November 3rd presidential election.
Well, tomorrow will be more a result of a protocol. So won't be much happening except the fact that the Electoral College will be delivering their votes. The next important event to be on January the 6th, when the Congress will count the votes, and is when we expect that some theatrical scenes will happen from the Republican Party trying to stop the counting of the votes. Because from the point of view of the legal point of view, as you know, Donald Trump lost 57 lawsuits in the different courts, including the Supreme Court twice, by the way. So on legal terms, he has no way to go. The only way to go now will be on January 6th. As I said, tomorrow will be the votes will be cast automatically without, I don't expect anything new tomorrow.
Well, for the current president of the U.S., the presidency has served him during these 4 years as a protective shield against the lawsuits that have been filed against him. Still, as of January 20th, 2021, he will have to face them like an ordinary citizen. To better explain the potential legal complications that Trump may face when he is gone, our correspondent Renny Carvalho has filed a report.
The presidency of Donald Trump has been full of controversy in many cases due to the lawsuits and investigations of a judicial nature that he faces. However, the president has so far managed to avoid them thanks to his position and to the defense provided in some cases by the Department of Justice. This shield has an expiration date, January 20, 2021, when a new president will be inaugurated. From then on, Trump will have to face, as any other citizen, the cases that have been accumulating during these years in the courts.
I think, though, that not only has there have been concerns about what Donald Trump has done before his presidency, I wouldn't be surprised if what he will do after his presidency as well. And so the types of potential criminal allegations that have been brought against him as well as his associates have quite compelling evidence. And I think that it will be hard prosecutors will be hard pressed to ignore that evidence.
The best case scenario for Trump is there are no lawsuits or they're just frivolous and dismissed by the courts. The worst case is that they're going to have something really serious against him where he could possibly even face prison time. This is hypothetical right now. We don't have a real case of that, but there are people digging into it.
Civil cases weigh him and investigations that could have criminal implications. At the center of the investigations are his taxes, the management of his business, the use of the presidency to benefit his interests, and the defamation complaints of women who accuse him of sexual abuse, which he has denied.
It is very possible that Donald Trump will try to pardon himself. We will be in completely new territory because, again, no president has tried this before, so the courts have never decided if it's legal or not.
Some U.S. media outlets are reporting about Mr. Trump has been asking aides since 2017 if he can self-pardon preemptively, especially on tax fraud accusations. So far, his attorneys have used the immunity argument granted by the presidency, but when he leaves the White House, they will have to reconsider his defense strategy. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Carvalho,
Death toll from COVID-19 in the U.S. is nearing 300,000 as the contagious disease continues to spread rapidly across the country. The U.S. has logged more than 13,000 deaths since the beginning of December. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit nation, having recorded over 16.2 million positive cases so far. Although the U.S. Center for Disease Control accepted the administration of Pfizer's vaccine, health experts warn the impact will not become evident until well into 2021. Meanwhile, Brazil has registered 279 daily fatalities, bringing its total death toll to over 181,000. The South American nation has so far recorded over 6.9 million infections. South Korea orders the closure of all schools in Seoul and neighboring areas in an attempt to contain the spike of COVID-19 cases in the capital. Officials say schools will hold online classes as of Tuesday until the end of the month. The move is a step towards the government's imposition of phase 3 social distancing rules, which will eventually lead to a lockdown. It comes after authorities reported more than 700 new coronavirus cases, mostly in Seoul. A number of cases are expected to surpass South Korea's previous peak in February. Now, the UK and the EU have agreed to return to the negotiating table after abandoning the Sunday night deadline they had set for hammering out a post-Brexit trade deal. The decision came after British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and EU Chief Ursula von der Leyen held one more crisis call. In a joint statement, the two leaders said they had mandated their negotiators to continue the talks and to see whether an agreement could be reached even at the late stage. It did not offer a new deadline, but a British Conservative lawmaker said the talks could go, quote, right to the wire. The new move came amid prevailing pessimism on both sides, with less than 3 weeks until Britain leaves the single market at the end of the month. Amina Taylor has given us a more detailed picture of the situation as the UK and the EU slide toward a Brexit without a trade deal.
One thing I think the viewers have to understand, this 31st of December deadline is a completely arbitrary one. There is no particular legislative reason why it has to be. Therefore, any conversations around whether or not Mrs. van der Leyen and Mr. Johnson can actually choose to see if there's some room to iron things out and perhaps avoid a no-deal Brexit, that is completely up to them. But what we're getting right now is a face-saving exercise where the Prime Minister wants to appear to be the man who's delivering on his take-back sovereignty from the 31st of December. We're in charge of our own destiny. The bottom line is a simple one. Even if the 31st happens and there is a, quote, no deal, there will still be bits that need to be ironed out. You'll have to engage in new protocols and processes and agreements with new trading partners. So this idea here that we're being taken to a cliff edge because it's politically expedient and also it suits this take-back control narratives, I think it's highly dangerous. And I think the public and the wider global community watching what has clearly become a chaotic situation should bear this very, very firmly in mind.
Boko Haram terrorists killed at least 27 people in an attack on a village in southeast Niger. A number of other people were wounded or reported as missing on Saturday evening after nearly 70 assailants attacked the village in the Difa region. A huge fire set by the attackers burnt up to 1,000 houses and the central market as well as numerous vehicles. A local official said nearly 60% of the village was destroyed in the attack that lasted 3 hours. The raid came hours before municipal and regional elections were held across the country. The vote had been postponed repeatedly due to Boko Haram attacks, which have frequently targeted the country since 2015. Now, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has urged the Moroccan parliament to criminalize normalization of ties between Rabat and Tel Aviv.
We call on the Moroccan parliament to criminalize the normalization with the Zionist occupation, enact the necessary laws to do so, and fight all its forms that only serve the interests of the enemy, no matter what the justifications or the price of these deals were.
The Hamas official condemned the normalization deal brokered by the U.S. He said the agreement contradicts the authenticity of Morocco and its people who support the Palestinian cause. As Zahar said, the deal is a stab in the back of Palestinians and a reward for Israel. The Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip also denounced the normalization deal between Morocco and Israel.
Normalization leads to the destruction of the Palestinian cause, an increase in the number of settlements, and the strengthening of the word Israel, meaning it gives it more strength to commit crimes against the Palestinians.
U.S. President Donald Trump announced the normalization agreement on Thursday. He said Rabat and Tel Aviv had agreed to full diplomatic ties, calling the move a historic breakthrough. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also called the deal historic. The move drew criticism from some Moroccan factions. Morocco is the fourth Arab state to normalize ties with Israel since August, after Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Sudan.
Angry reactions continue to pour in against the recent normalization of ties between Morocco and Israel. This time, Palestinian Legislative Council in the Gaza Strip held a press conference to condemn the deal that came at the expense of the Palestinian cause.
Normalization is not a normal. It's a misleading term. It is a misleading term. It is a false term. There is no normalization with the occupation in the history. Every country suffered from occupation, tried by all means to defend themselves, even by armed struggle, in order to liberate their land. For this reason, we are refusing normalization of any country, especially a country like Morocco.
Morocco is the fourth state to make such an agreement with Israeli regime since August, despite the Moroccan people's refusal of the deal that has also been struck recently with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan. The Moroccan king claimed he agreed to start the relations with Israel to expand economic and cultural cooperation and advance regional stability and peace.
These deals can never bring peace for Israel. The current crisis will never come to an end until the last Zionist leaves our land. The normalization deals only embolden Israel to commit more crimes.
Palestinians call on the Arab nations to dismiss these normalization deals and protest against their leaders' decisions that Palestinians consider a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
Israeli regime should be put on trial for its crimes and violations of Palestinian rights in the International Criminal Court. The Arab nations should voice their anger at the normalization deals.
U.S. used Morocco's Western Sahara claim as a bargaining chip in talks with Morocco to secure the deal and agreed to recognize Rabat's sovereignty over the territory. While the fourth Arab country has started normalizing ties with the Israeli regime, Palestinians here stress that no deal can bring peace to the occupied territories. They say that resistance is the only way to defend the Palestinian rights. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Media reports suggest a convoy of American military vehicles laden with stolen Syrian oil have left the Hasaka countryside in the Arab country heading for Iraq. According to local sources, the convoy comprised of 85 tanks and other vehicles left Syria for Iraq via a border crossing that Damascus says is illegal. In recent months, the U.S. occupation forces have reportedly taken out dozens of vehicles laden with stolen Syrian oil from Hasaka to the Iraqi territories. Syria says the U.S. presence is aimed at plundering the nation's resources and reinforcing its foothold in the country. The United States reportedly began constructing a new military facility in the Syrian province of Deir ez-Zor back in October, making it the fourth illegal base that Washington is operating in the province. Iranian lawmakers have voiced their protest against the Turkish president's meddlesome remarks during his visit to the Republic of Azerbaijan. The MPs say Recep Tayyip Erdogan's words were detrimental to regional peace and stability. Human Abedi now reports.
The recitation of a poem by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan during a military parade in Azerbaijan Republic was strongly condemned by the Iranian lawmakers and the government officials. Right after his statements, which Iran believes may fan separatism among Azeri minority, Tehran summoned the Turkish envoy. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif in a tweet rejected the remarks, saying that no one can talk about Iran's quote, beloved Azerbaijan. Although the Turkish foreign minister has given assurances in a phone call with Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif that Ankara respects the Islamic Republic's sovereignty and territorial integrity, the members of the parliament vehemently slammed such remarks.
In whatever way, direct or indirect, in form of a poem or any other form, such interventionist remarks are vehemently rejected by Iran. We call on the friendly state of Turkey to be watchful about their official statements, which may result in controversy. We respect the territorial integrity of the Azerbaijan Republic and Turkey and expect them to do the same.
The poem recited by Erdogan is ethnically sensitive. A president must know the repercussions of his rhetoric. This was a wrong move by the Turkish president.
Such assertions have always been strongly rejected by the Iranian officials and nation. No one is allowed to talk about Iran's territorial integrity.
Erdogan's statements come as his efforts to join the EU have been futile, and the Europeans impose more and more sanctions on Ankara under different pretexts.
Earlier, the Iranian lawmakers issued a statement condemning the remarks by the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, saying that such remarks may put the security of the region at risk. Human Abedi, Tehran.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Merciful, the all-compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end, success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makes the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In the limelight.
The U.S. society is dominated by the rich, who have the ultimate say on public policy and elections. If one wants to understand how policy is determined in the U.S., one will need to look at the opinions of the wealthy and how they invest their money. The U.S. political system features inauthentic political parties that lack organized public participation, and where elite-run candidate selection institutions reflect the opinions and interests of the rich. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Raiko Kalandais, writer. This article is published under the heading, "Biden's victory was hardly a win for democracy. It was another win for the 1%. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Biden administration, many have proclaimed that a triumph of democracy has taken place. But was Joe Biden's win really a victory for democracy? The evidence suggests otherwise, by a wide margin. The 2020 election was the most expensive election on record, with Democrats outspending Republicans in both congressional and federal contests. Spending was just shy of $14 billion in total. an unprecedented record and double the amount of 2016. In fact, the Biden campaign broke monthly and online campaign funding contributions of all time, boosted in large part by Wall Street donors. Biden's campaign, in fact, became the first ever to raise over $1 billion in campaign donations. Donald Trump, on the other hand, finished second in total campaign contributions by a presidential candidate, beating out Obama's 2008 record-shattering numbers. In fact, this characterizes the overall trends. The Financial Times writes that listed companies increased their donations to Democratic group this year over the Republicans, noting that this was a sign that executives are trying to win favor with liberals on expectations of conservative defeats nationwide in the November elections. Furthermore, both presidential campaigns were boosted by unprecedented outside spending by big money super PACs and dark money groups that were bolstered by ultra-wealthy individuals. In fact, the greater the contributions, the less transparent the Biden campaign became with records, even going as far as declining to disclose the names of its most prominent fundraisers. If we take an even closer look, the picture becomes even bleaker, revealing how undemocratic the United States of America really is. Political scientist Thomas Ferguson, an authoritative scholar on money and electoral politics, has a valuable and established political science theory called the investment theory of politics. It demonstrates that the United States of America is essentially controlled by coalitions of investors who come together around some mutual interest. Thus, to participate in the political arena, you must have enough resources and private power to become part of such a coalition. He argues that since the early 19th century, there has been a persistent struggle for power among these groups of investors. Moments of conflict come along when groups of investors have differing points of view on public policy, while on policies where large investors are in agreement, no party struggle takes part. Importantly, parties attempt to change the public's opinion to match those of its investors. These findings are applicable elsewhere. In fact, further research by Ferguson and his colleagues on the effect of wealthy investors and money on election outcomes has shown that campaign expenditures are an excellent predictor of U.S. congressional races. Money in American politics suggests that analysis of the American political system should begin by looking closely at money politics when they attempt to understand political change, especially political systems steady shift to the right since the late 1960s. Our tentative conclusion is that seeing should, after all, be believing. The case in favor of the proportion that money drives U.S. elections is significantly strengthened. Ferguson's research on the political power of the rich is no outlier either. A major study by Princeton scholar Martin Gillens and Northwestern University professor Benjamin Page reveals that the vast majority of the population, about 70% on the lower end of the wealth and income scale, is essentially excluded from policy decisions and effectively unrepresented. They conclude that as you move up the scale, influence gradually increases. More importantly, when you reach the very top of the scale, these affluent groups essentially determine policy. The authors reveal that regardless of a Republican or Democratic head of government, the government follows the policy preferences of major lobbying or business groups rather than policy preferences of the general population. They determine that if policymaking is dominated by powerful business organizations and a small number of affluent Americans, then America's claims to being a democratic society are seriously threatened. Yet, even with these stark conclusions, the study had its limitations. One is that it didn't show who among the rich and wealthy has the greatest influence. Additionally, it excluded major business groups such as the Business Council and the Committee for Economic Development, and neglected to note the importance of individual firms and investors. The latest research published this year by two analysts, Sean Maguire and Charles D. Hunt, fills these gaps and builds upon this work, reinforcing the observations even further. Utilizing artificial intelligence and machine learning, Maguire and D. Hunt advance the thesis by showing it is actually worse than what others have found. Their study reveals and confirms that the top wealthiest 10% ultimately always win on policy, effectively showing that anyone else's opinion outside of top 10% rarely matters. Thus, the preferences of the top 10%, along with the opinions of certain interest groups, can effectively explain and determine how policy is hammered out with remarkable accuracy. As such, the opinions of those in the lower scale of income reduces the accuracy of prediction in accordance with Gillen's and Page's similar findings. Maguire and De Hunt's objective was to examine to what degree legislative outcomes could be predicted based on the preferences of the rich, and, to a lesser extent, business interest groups by applying a machine learning tool to Gillen's and Page's data set on 1,836 major U.S. federal government policies, policy opinions of the top 10 richest in income percentile, and interest group preferences to build a predictive model of U.S. policy. Their conclusion was strong. Policy outcomes were predictable with a 70% degree accuracy, utilizing the policy preferences of those in 90th income percentile, showing the rich speak with their wallets. In fact, they even note that while 90th income percentile functions as a proxy for the opinions of elites, the results would probably fare even better if they had data on the opinions of the top 1%. They conclude what is generally suspected. The likely lodestar variable affecting policy outcomes is the transfer of large amounts of money to policymakers from the wealthiest sources focused intensely on particular policies. Every new study that concerns the power of the rich on U.S. democracy is more striking than the last. Biden's election victory only adds more evidence to these overall trends. In fact, as we have seen, this isn't at all surprising. U.S. society is dominated by the rich, who have the ultimate say on public policy and elections. If one wants to understand how policy is determined in the United States of America, one will need to look at the opinions of the wealthy and how they invest their money. The U.S. political system features inauthentic political parties that lack organized public participation, and where elite-run candidate selection institutions reflect the opinions and interests of the rich. As a result, the feelings of discontent are clear through the gradual rise of conspiracy theories, the rise of con artist politicians like Donald Trump, and the rise of religious fundamentalism and other social ills. Yet, it is important to note that 82% of Americans not unrealistically hold the opinion that the rich have too much influence in politics. A majority of the population favor a wealth tax on the rich. Thus, recent proclamations of a restoration of democracy are nothing war than fallacy, contrary to recent mainstream pronouncements. In light of all this, Maguire and DeHaan comment that it is strange to observe the fight for democracy currently playing out on screens across the U.S., yet the underlying disease, money-driven policy outcomes, leading to present-day symptoms goes mostly unspoken. Additionally, the current election is of critical importance, but a society that pins its hopes for democracy on quadrennial extravaganzas heavily funded by wealthy interests will be disappointed, as these players will perpetually win the game. It is very important to note that this doesn't mean that all is lost. In order for the general population to have a say in their affairs, they would need, as Page and Gillen's advocate, a social movement for democracy to counter the extraordinary power of the wealthiest of the society of the U.S. This movement, they note, should be similar to the Civil Rights and New Deal era movements. To this end, if the Biden administration were to cancel a student and medical debt or pass extremely popular policies like Medicare for All, an authentic and organized mass movement is the only way to make progressive policies possible.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Economic divide.
It is being hailed as the world's largest free trade deal in history. It encompasses 15 nations across the Asia-Pacific region, including Australia, China, Indonesia, Japan, and South Korea, which incidentally sees the five nations just mentioned also being members of the G20, making the new Asia-Pacific trade deal an exciting prospect for that bloc. Now labeled as the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or the RCEP, the Mega Free Trade Pact came into place just recently, allowing the member nations to enjoy multiple advantages, including the reduction of tariffs, simplified customs agreements, and a reduction in trade costs, to name a few. Well, the agreement appears to have some common traits with other existing global trade deals. For example, in the case of the EU, with the free movement of people being a key aspect, which for some could see many people in member nations being given new opportunities, hence lifting them out of poverty.
Information age, digitalization, they can learn from each other's experiences, and the people-to-people movement will be very freely movement like EU. So this kind of agreements always bring fruitful results for the local people, the poverty alleviation, the joining technology transfers.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Afway. In this week's show, we'll be taking a deeper look into the signing of the RCEP and ascertain just how it may benefit various countries who have become members, and examine just how big of an impact the RCEP will have on the global economy. Now, just as a point of note, following our exclusive story that was covered right here on Economic Divide surrounding the Air Canada scandal. So, just how big a deal is the RCEP? For starters, the negotiations over the agreement have taken 8 years, and now that it has been signed and sealed, the member nations of the RCEP account for 1/3 of the world's population, and more importantly, some 29% of the total world GDP, making the RCEP larger than the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement and the European Union. The impact of the RCEP is likely to have on the global economy, well, is also a highlight of the pact, with the Peterson Institute for International Economics stating that the deal could see an increase in global national income of around $186 billion. NC member states have their GDPs increased by at least 0.2%. The pact could have been a lot bigger, in fact, incorporating half the world's population. For example, in this case, we're referring to India. India, with its 1.35 billion people and huge economy. Well, it was also part of that plan, yet India pulled out at the 11th hour as it felt that by signing the deal, it would see its own economy and industry suffer. However, the door has been left open for India to join at any time in the future.
The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or the RCEP, is the world's largest free trade deal and has taken 8 years to formulate. With 15 member nations, including five of which are in the G20, the partnership is set to allow member nations to trade together on a more fluid basis and hopefully allow the region to expand economically together. Traditionally, the Asian Pacific area has enjoyed similar trade deals in the past, but with multilateralism becoming an ever more popular concept around the world, in an attempt to break current hegemonies, the notion of global cooperation has some interesting advantages. Already, the European Union is an example of a successful regional trade pact, and there are numerous others around the world. So how then does the RCEP compare with such agreements? Are there any similarities, and are there any differences?
Yeah, obviously, there are some overlaps between this new agreement and other existing agreements, such as the Asian Free Trade and others. But as we understand, there are also some bigger differences between this new one and the existing ones. For example, there have been new countries who joined the agreement. In addition to Asian countries, we have New Zealand and Australia as new members. And this will bring together a bigger force to promote free regional trade.
With the introduction of new countries into the deal, with the likes of New Zealand and Australia now being part of the RCEP, there's now a very good opportunity to demonstrate that regional cooperation could be a perfect tool to promote development and trade. What now remains to be seen is whether the nations aligned to the RCEP can overcome political differences and concentrate on trade to bolster economies, all looking to emerge from the impact of the coronavirus that's done so much damage around the world.
How do the benefits of being a member of the RCEP convert into numbers? Well, for smaller nations, the impact is immediate, with the likes of Vietnam seeing their GDP rising anything between 2 and 4%, which, for Vietnam, is a significant increase, which will no doubt be emulated by other smaller economy members. The market scale of the RCEP is also interesting when put into numbers. As we have already mentioned, the deal results in about 29% of the world GDP, which is some $26.2 trillion US dollars, and equates to a sum of 32.5% of global investment. The advantages are also truly regional, as most of the trade between Asia-Pacific nations is conducted within the area. Examples of this are the $532.6 billion per year that Australia enjoys with the region, and for New Zealand, it accounts for 56% of the country's exports, providing 61% of the total foreign investment into the country. Again, proving that the RCEP will be most fruitful.
There's no doubt that as the world's second largest economy and rising fast, China firmly has its eyes set on the top spot in the world, with many suggesting that China overtaking the US at the top of the economic ladder is not a case of if, but when. For some, The RCEP has been criticized as it will more than likely benefit China more than other signatory members. With China being the economic powerhouse behind the agreement, it seems that China in particular has a lot to gain by having 14 other free trade partners at its disposal. The economic expansion sought by China and demonstrated through the likes of the One Belt, One Road initiative are clear examples of how China is using trade to expand its footprint around the world. And as we deal with trade wars, COVID-19 and economic uncertainty, the RCEP is an example of China's multilateral adaptability to its economic roadmap.
Well, I think speaking of China, we need to think about, we need to put this against the general background of Chinese economic strategy. China has been promoting very hard its very ambitious One Belt and One Road project across the globe. And it comes at a very interesting time. We are now in the middle of a global pandemic. We are also seeing an escalating tension between China and the U.S. and also some regional countries. So I think this is something that will be supplementing China's One Belt, One Road project.
However, not 1 month into the agreement, and already small economic skirmishes have started to occur, in particular between Australia and China, where China has imposed tariffs on Australian wine, as well as seeing diplomatic tension rise over the abuse of civilians by the Australian military in Afghanistan, something that China has highly condemned. On a wider scale, tension between the US and the Chinese has also led to a war of words and trade between Washington and Beijing. However, with the tide set to turn in the US with the election of Joe Biden as president, a new government in the White House may see Biden's multilateral form of diplomacy reach out to China and once again see ties restored, fixing the damage committed by Donald Trump.
I'm pleased to say that joining me in the studio today is Martin Lockett, professor of strategic management from Nottingham University Business School, China. Currently based in Ningbo, Professor Lockett has over 40 years' experience in Chinese culture, economy, management, and development, and has worked on multiple consultancy projects and education programs in China. Professor, many thanks for joining us here on Economic Divide.
It's very good to be with you.
So first up, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, RCEP, a huge project, as you're well aware, and it has been labeled as the world's largest free trade agreement, 8 years in the making. How important do you think this deal is, and how will this spark the regional economy off in the post-pandemic era?
We are absolutely right that this is one of the world's largest free trade agreements, if not the largest. It's going to cover 15 countries with about 30% of the world's population and 30% of the world's economy. That includes China, Japan, South Korea, the 10 Asian countries, Australia and New Zealand. So it's going to make much of Asia-Pacific into a free trade zone. It's going to be a bit like the European Union or the North America in that respect. So it's been estimated over time that it will have a very big impact. One from some professors at Johns Hopkins University in the US estimates a positive impact of $186 billion in terms of global income. However, that's only really 0.2% of the world economy, so it's still limited in that respect.
Okay, well, you got five members of the RCEP who are in the G20. How do you think the trade deal will benefit the larger economies in the region? For one, many are stating already that the big winner in this deal is China. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, clearly China's going to be a winner. It's going to help overall economic development in all the countries. So in that sense, you've got 15 winners. Actually, the losers are going to be probably the US and India. Now, that's not so much that they're going to get real damage to their economies from this, but they're going to lose opportunities. So one estimate about India was it might have a small economic damage from the impact of the free trade zone elsewhere, but it's going to lose opportunities compared with what if it took part. So from that viewpoint, it's the what we sometimes call opportunity costs that are the big ones for those who are not taking part, and benefits for all those taking part. If we look politically, then I think it can be seen as a demonstration of multilateralism in practice by China. And I think that's where possibly the biggest benefit to China lies, in its showing a commitment to multilateralism.
And finally, the legacy left by Donald Trump saw China and the U.S. fall into a bitter trade war. That may or may not improve under the new administration. Will then a deal as big as the RCEP spark a wider global battle as allies to the U.S. and the EU attempt to compete with such a deal? Or they solely have to accept that multilateralism is the way forward and adapt accordingly?
Well, I think the EU and USA will accept this deal. I think it's likely that the new U.S. administration, led by the soon-to-be President Biden, will adopt a more multilateral approach and will look at how it can extend those agreements and maybe get back into some that it's left under President Trump. I mean, I think the U.S. could potentially seek to extend the RCEP to bring back its previous idea of something called the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, CPTPP. It's a little bit of a mouthful, but that was essentially a rather wider agreement that also involved the U.S. So for now, I think we see three big trading blocks, the EU, the Americas, and RCEP, and then outside it, some countries like India and potentially the UK after Brexit.
Okay, thank you so much. Thanks there to Professor Martin Lockett from Nottingham University Business School, China. Great hearing your thoughts and information. Many thanks for being with us on the show.
Thank you.
Okay, lots of interesting ideas there. Of course, we still have to wait for Joe Biden, the president-elect, to be confirmed. All right, we're about to take a short break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere as we have plenty more coming up after the break. We'll be joined by our regular researcher and journalist, Atifa Tajidar. She runs us through some of the stories hitting social media pages surrounding the RCEP. Also look at how smaller economies will benefit or lose out from joining the RCEP, as well as taking a look at how other global trade agreements will react to the creation of the RCEP. Also, a deeper look at the impact of the COVID-19 virus on the Asia-Pacific economy in our in-depth section. Time now for our in-depth section. Much like the rest of the world, the COVID-19 virus has had a heavy impact on the economies of the nations in the Asia-Pacific region. A report by Oxford Economics highlights this, that this region is going to be recovering the fastest once the pandemic subsides. Now, move on to the next report, and our in-depth look comes from the World Bank, and what it states is that global GDPs will contract on average at a rate of 2.8% for 2020, growing to around 6% in 2021. Yet for China, well, that's going to benefit. 9% is what is going to rise in terms of GDP, in part assisted by the extra trade generated from the signing of the RCEP. And finally, when compared to the rest of the world, one of the main issues will be the time that it takes to recover. And much like an injury on a person, this depends on the depth of the scar. For example, looking here for the UK, it saw its economy fall by nearly 25% during the peak of the pandemic. In South Korea, for example, a member of the RCEP, saw its economy shrink by only 7.6%, far lower than the global average of 12 to 14%. Let's now take a look at how smaller Asia-Pacific economies will benefit or not from the new RCEP deal in our next report.
We've already discussed the notion that China and other larger economies will benefit from the RCEP, but what then of the smaller economies in the pact? With the likes of Brunei, Vietnam, Thailand, and others in the agreement, as well as larger economies such as Malaysia, Indonesia, Australia, and New Zealand, the pot is well mixed in nations and economy sizes joining together, raising the question as to just what benefits the smaller nations may see from being a member of the RCEP.
From my understanding, I think there will be some impact, but in terms of positive impact, it may be very limited. Because if you look at the history of these countries trading with each other within the bloc, I think they have already enjoyed a very high level of free trade with each other. So with the new countries joining the club, if we are looking at China as the biggest player in the region, I'm not sure how these countries will be able to benefit.
So is the RCEP then just a rewording of existing agreements in place? And if so, how can smaller nations adapt a deal to suit their needs? The benefits of the RCEP will be bespoke to each member state. Yet for Vietnam, for example, figures suggest that the GDP of the country could rise by as much as 4%, which could play a significant part in the future economy of the nation.
We need to sign this moment to reform our economy so that we can soon bounce back and assert our central position in world economy.
But lower down the scale, when it comes to the predictions of how the RCEP will benefit nations, is a much smaller growth rate. Although the RCEP area is huge when combined, some of the smaller nations could only see a 0.2% growth in their GDP, which makes one question the benefits of joining such a scheme. However, one must also acknowledge the notion of regional cooperation and solidarity, as to when it comes to trade, diplomacy and politics, there's no more important entity than one's own neighbours, and when push comes to shove, knowing they're there is a comforting feeling.
Time now to bring in researcher and journalist Adolphe Padidot to tell us more about the RCEP. Welcome. So tell us what you got for us for this, I guess, the biggest trading bloc in the world.
So let's see what I picked. The first one is from Peter Draper, and he is talking about a piece which talks about this trade pact is one small geoeconomic step or a giant eastward leap in a geostrategic gravity. This guy is obviously talking about with this trade pact, we're going to witness a shift of power from west to east. Something to think about. Let's go to the next tweet.
Sure. Let's see what this one is.
This one, Dr. Rizwan is saying, RCEP will help recover members from pandemic losses at rapid pace. Well, this is one of the hopes that members of this pact are signing the agreement because of this, because China obviously is recovering faster than others, and it can help other members of the pact to recover more rapidly. Our final tweet is from someone who is against this trade pact. Harsh Shah says, it was foolish to enter into RCEP with non-market economy with so much state enterprises. China market economy stance is namesake, which one should not fall trap into.